about Harry Potter and why he is so successful and why he's so accepted, you know, universally by all people, how much they love to read and listen. So I rented the tape and I listened to the movie, and I'd like to tell you what I saw. Now, the thing is in Harry Potter, the first fantasy is, you see, a person in his emotions feels that that his wishes can come true, and therefore that's the reason why people believe in magic, because they hold that wishes could come true. Okay. In a society where it's based on science, like, well, not so much today as years ago, it's still there in the unconscious. It's still there, and it affects certain decisions and certain feelings that you have, but it doesn't show up consciously. But however, that idea is a very, very powerful emotion, because whenever you're jealous or somebody hurts you and you want to hurt them back, so your wishes, and if you can't do anything about it, so then you wish on them bad things, you see? Now, the first part of Harry Potter is you see that his wishes come true. You see, when the people that he was staying by were mean to him, so certain things happened based on his wishes, even though he didn't realize he had the power. So that is the first step, that you win over reality through your wishes and your unconscious, where reality frustrates you or doesn't allow you an outlet. So you have an outlet in the world of fantasy, where your dreams and your wishes are true. The reason why I said that, he didn't realize he has the power, because later on in the movie they show that he had certain powers based on birth.
Oh, well, I didn't know. Thank you.
So that already satisfies the tremendous desire in the person to want to have that. Okay? Then he enters a totally new world, the world of where everything is magic. They even have their own terms, different games. Everything is different, and it's a totally different world. You enter into a different world, and that is the child like escaping from reality, where reality is very powerful and frustrates him, so he moves out into his own world where he could be extremely successful in his magical world, and he doesn't have to deal with reality. In the first part, he deals with reality, but he deals with reality in a magical way. The second step is a step removed from reality, is where you move into your own world where there is no reality. There's only the reality which you created with all this magic, you see? So that's a very powerful thing also for escaping the world of reality. And then the second thing is that you have in the unconscious the world of good and evil, the battle from good and evil, and here it's the child that's in conflict with the evil that's like an adult, the evil adult, and who controls him, and the different authorities that he has to deal with in reality, you see, they become the evil, and he has more power than this evil person, you see, and his power is able to overcome the power of evil, you see, just by love. You see, all you have to have is a feeling of love, and you're not interested in desire, in great desires, so then you'll be totally successful over the evil authority that should have more power. You are stronger than them. That is basically the powerful emotions that are being satisfied for the people that that read Harry Potter or watch Harry Potter. So that I think those are very powerful emotions of escaping the problems and conflicts that reality offer. So it's a way of escaping that reality. The question is, isn't that the same thing with many movies? I mean, that they have this escapism. Yeah, the thing is that could be that there are other movies or other books that are also very successful. But this hit on, I don't know, I'm not familiar with all the movies out there and why they're successful or failing. But all I could tell you is about this one is that it had the winning over reality with wishes, that your wishes work, the escape from reality into your own world, and the ability to destroy authority, that you have more power than authority in your world, and therefore you escape into this world where you could win over authority, and part of the authority is also reality. So it's a total escape from reality. Also, I noticed that whenever the hero, Harry Potter, is in trouble, it's always very short. They don't keep it for a long period. Like the fear, a certain level of fear, but however, for a very short period, then he immediately gets out of the different situations that he gets into, that he has. It's always very short-lived, and they immediately are successful. So they have the conflict, but they keep that down to a very short, so you sense the conflict, and then you win over the conflict with magic. Which quality makes this different than the other movies or books that are successful in fantasy? I cannot tell you exactly, you know what I mean? All I could tell you is what I saw here, and I'm not familiar with all the other areas. Okay? This is this observation that I did, that we just made is based on the first movie of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Okay? I haven't seen the second one or read the book. Bruno Bettelheim is a psychoanalyst, and he wrote a book on fairy tales. And if you remember some of the fairy tales, most fairy tales is where there's the giant or the genie that you're in trouble with, or like by Hansel and Gretel, your life is in danger by the wicked witch, and they work it out through trickery, you see. So, I don't know, again, I'm not familiar with all the fairy tales, but a lot of fairy tales is where your adversary is much stronger than you are, much more powerful, but you win over through thought, through thinking. So in that way, the fairy tales are better than Harry Potter in helping the child deal with reality, and trying to teach him through the fairy tale, not by telling him, not by openly discussing the ideas, but through the fairy tale, the child unconsciously picks up the idea that you must deal with the mind to win over the more powerful things more powerful enemies, or with the power of reality. Where reality is very difficult, so the answer is in the mind. The question is, does the child really know what's going on? The child does not know consciously what's going on, and through the fairy tale, the child tries to work out his conflict with reality. And through the fairy tale, he works out his reality. Now, the same thing with Harry Potter. They use Harry Potter to, it affects them unconsciously how to deal with your various conflicts. It never comes to the conscious mind in the child. It's working it out all unconsciously. But by Harry Potter, they try to give you the fantasy that you can, through your unconscious powers that really do not work, you could be successful. While many fairy tales, but most fairy tales, where you win, you tricked out the adversary, you tricked them out by thought, through a mind. Now the child unconsciously identifies with the one that wins over the evil, you see, and he, through the fairy tale, he works through, he knows that he has to do with the mind. Okay? But there's also a problem with this also, because it's still the child is working it out through his unconscious, and the question is, how much it will help him work and live with the conscious. It doesn't help him. In other words, at a certain point, the child has to deal with reality. And it is possible, even through the fairy tale, the child can avoid, it could use the fairy tale to avoid reality and not deal directly with reality. Okay? So therefore, I mean, in other words, sometimes when a child has a problem with reality, it's better to try as close as possible. You have to know when and where. I mean, how old the child is and what the child could accept, how to explain the reality. Okay? In other words, to try to bring the child into a realistic world in a slow process, but dealing directly with the world of reality.
Okay.
In the Torah, we also have different various stories through the Torah in our relationship with God and our relationship with other people. And the child can relate to these ideas, and also, of course, the unconscious is going to identify with different heroes. But the fact is that the other books, at a certain point, we assume the child will give it up and move on. Here, the child can stick to this book, which he learned to love and identify with the different heroes of the Torah, and then come back to it, and then to start building rationally from what he felt emotionally and how he related emotionally, to start pulling out and to analyze the Torah more rationally. So therefore, the same book that helped him deal with his problems, the same book will help him pull out of his problems and deal in a more, in other words, in a more, to deal with his problems in a more realistic manner. So in that way, the Torah is a very good book for constant development. There are different ways that the child, and sometimes even adults that never get out of that childish view, there are different ways in which to deal with reality, in which the emotions deal with reality. One way is to advocate and to build and to live and to move into the world of fantasy. That's the Harry Potter approach. That fantasy is good and it's successful, and you could win out in life that way through these fantasies. The fairy tale uses fantasy, but it's supposed to, by using the fantasy, to help you get to a certain reality. Okay, but it is using fantasy, and you're living in the fantasy world. While the Torah uses real stories that the child could identify with different heroes and deal with his unconscious conflicts and deal with it through the Torah, but then the very book could help him pull out of it as he gets involved in the book and the abstract more ideas. So he gets more involved in the world of ideas, and soon he pulls out of the world of fantasy and starts living his life based on the world of reality. I'm saying, the question is that I'm talking about adult, not a child. I'm saying the child can be told or read the stories of the Bible, of the Torah, right? And when he hears these stories, he will identify with different characters, right? So he will identify and work through the different areas, okay, in his unconscious, not realizing it, okay? But they're real stories. They're not fake. They're not fantasy. You see, they're things that have happened. But however, he still will relate to it. The child must relate to it in a fantasy way. But then, as he grows, in fact, he relates even to the physical world in a fantasy way. Okay. So the thing is that. But however, if he enjoys the stories and he relates to these stories. So then he will identify with this book as helping him deal with his conflict. So that's a good feeling towards the book. Then he will continue, and he doesn't have to leave the book. He continue working in that book. And then when he's working in the book, he starts developing and start thinking through the ideas, like, you know, like we discussed in class, to see the different ideas, each according to the child's level or as he becomes an adult. And then he could actually start at a certain point, start pulling out of the fantasy world and start dealing with reality in a realistic manner. This process is definitely a lifelong process of developing. And how fast or how slow you develop, each according to their personality and their abilities, can develop through the world of the study of Torah.
Oh, I have no...
In other words, the question is that some of the stories are not totally satisfying in the Torah. The stories are not as satisfying as in the other areas.
Not realistic.
Right, because they're more, you know, I mean, because... you know, at the end, Samson dies, and, you know, I mean, some of them are not so satisfying to the emotions, which is a good thing. A child has to know that he can't always be satisfied, and he has to deal with reality. He has to deal with the successes, and he has to recognize that sometimes reality doesn't always work out perfectly. But however, you have to work with reality the best you can, but you cannot rely on your fantasy to deal with reality. That definitely will bring to failure. In other words, if you live within the fantasy world, that will definitely lead to failure. But however, if you live in the reality world, there's a better chance of success. The child has certain unconscious view of reality, okay? And they have terrible conflicts between their unconscious view and reality. And so therefore they have to work through these conflicts, okay? And now these different mediums, the Harry Potter or fairy tales or the Torah itself, these stories, when they hear these stories, they start to work through. They have to relate to it through their unconscious. They're not on the level of reality yet. Now, they can, in their unconscious, it doesn't come to the conscious mind, and you cannot bring it to the conscious mind. That will harm them. They just must deal with it on their own, in their own way, and each one how they relate, why one kid wants to hear one fairy tale 1,000 times and one kid wants to hear a different one. Each one is helping them relate. The reason why they like one over the other, that one helps them relate. We'd say that try to keep it as close to reality as possible, that relationship. Now, the child might pick up on one story that's more satisfying than the others, and he'll deal with it that way. But like in the Torah, he'll pick up on one story over the other in the Torah too. And he'll relate to, he must relate to it in his unconscious fantasy world. And you cannot bring it to the conscious too early, because that will harm him. The only thing is you could bring him out of the world of fantasy by slowly, and you have to be very careful. You do it too fast, or you do the wrong thing at the wrong time, the child can be hurt, can be very harmed. So you have to know how to do it. I'm just saying the Torah book doesn't do it by itself. He has to have a good teacher that's guiding the child from the relationship to a story, from a story level, to start teaching him and guiding him on an intellectual quest through the Torah. There are a lot of people that wanted to get Harry Potter off the shelf. I believe their reason was basically a Christian view that that they have a different type of superstition than Harry Potter had. So it was their fantasy against the fantasy of Harry Potter. So they didn't want you to go into magic. They held that was like pagan, you see. So it's for, they were against it, but for a different reason than what I'm against it. In other words, if your child wants to read Harry Potter, so the question is, should you let him? On one hand, the message that Harry Potter is not giving a good message. On the other hand, sometimes you can't fight if all his friends are reading it. I mean, I don't know if it's worth fighting. You have to know which is going to cause more damage in the child, refusing him to let him read it or to fight him on it. Sometimes you could lose more by fighting him on it. So that's a hard decision. But however, the thing is that even if he does read Harry Potter, how to deal with it, I mean, you have to be very careful. You can't tell him these ideas which we discussed here on the tape. That could be very harmful. It's too open. You're dealing openly with his emotions. That you have to be at a certain development to deal with it, you see? And it's better just to deal with ideas of reality. What is reality? You understand? Not the how the emotions look at reality, but just dealing with the what is reality and ideas of cause and effect. You know what I mean? I mean, not talk about cause and effect. That's too abstract. But to talk about different things and how they work in reality. But don't bring it out so clearly that it's a total conflict with Harry Potter. But it's a slow process of change from the world of logic to the from the world of fantasy to the world of logic, to the world of thinking. And the process, I'm not defining what the process is. It's a very difficult thing. And the thing is, all I'm saying is that you have to know what you're doing when you're moving from one place, from the fantasy to the world of reality. You have to know what you're doing to bring him out slowly. In other words, if you show him too early what his emotions are, he'll become terribly confused and he can't deal with it anymore. And that's a very dangerous thing. I mean, like, for instance, if a child is at a certain age, there are many stories and many strategies of war in Torah. I would thought that he would be interested in that, especially a boy would be interested in that. A girl would be more interested if I would show her the different strategies of women in the Torah and how they worked out their lives, the different areas, but the real reality of it. You know, how to logically work out your life, not how the emotions relate to it and not how to deal with the emotions. That's a further development, dealing directly with the emotions. The first step is training him in thinking about life. You see? But not to go directly how the emotions deal with life. That could cause conflict until the child is ready for it. That's a correct observation. We start out totally as emotional beings and the mind slowly develops. That's why we have a bat mitzvah at 12 and a bar mitzvah at 13, because we say that's first when they're about ready to start dealing with the commandments and the mitzvos and to deal with the studies and ideas. the brain is developed at that point, that you could start more. It doesn't mean you shouldn't start with certain ideas before, but the responsibility is about that age and when the mind is developed. But however, you should start out earlier with certain ideas of thinking about reality, not about the emotions. Now, the question is why does a person, why at 13? I mean, is that a magical number? It's not that it's a magical number. It's just that most people, I mean, we had a prophet that he was 9 years old. Another one was 13 when he had prophecy. I mean, so there are certain people that develop extremely early, and there's certain people that develop extremely late, and at 13 they're now ready to take on responsibility. But in general, the general populace is about the age of 13 for a boy and 12 for a girl. It seems like Torah holds that a woman matures a little bit quicker than a boy, and she could take on responsibility at 12 and a boy at 13. But that's a general thing. It's not a magical term. It's just in general, it works that way. All right. There's a question that in the past I one time said that there's relating to God as a authority figure and relating to God as the source of reality. And the question was to ask me to elaborate on that idea. Okay, it's pretty much what we're saying now, that when you start out, you must start out in a fantasy world, and you look at God as your protector, and you must obey, and he has certain commands of you, and you obey those commands, you see. So he becomes the authority figure. We hold that the reason why we do things is because it's realistic, it's a reality to do it, you see. And as you study, when you study the ideas of either halacha or the different sciences, and you start looking for ideas and concepts, so you become attached to the world of ideas and wisdom. And then you see God's wisdom in the universe. And then when you see God's wisdom in the universe, there's a certain desire to know the source of all this wisdom, because you relate to God through wisdom, you see. But you must start out on the other area where there is a certain battle between you and, I would say a battle, I mean, certain people have a battle with God, and therefore they have a problem because they look at him as just another authority, you see. And if you're a person that has certain rebellious attitudes, so then you look at him as a authority, another authority to rebel against, you see. But if you have a feeling that he's a benevolent authority, so when he's going to help you, so then you turn to him, you see. But however, the ultimate is the looking at God as the source. Through your knowledge and wisdom, you're drawn to God through his knowledge and wisdom, and then you want to know the source of all this wisdom. And even halacha becomes a realistic thing, because since God is the source of all reality, you know, like if you look at law in general is not a science that you abstract. You use the physical. Like, for instance, you cannot determine if something is in somebody's hand. Just the fact that it's in this hand, the question is, does he own it? Did he borrow it? Or did he steal it? Just because you're in possession of the thing, so the law tells you whether it's yours or not. You understand? Like, possession is 9/10 of the law. I mean, there are different rules, but it's not abstracted from reality. So all law is really not reality. It's just a practical way of relating in the world. It's a practical way of relating in the world. However, the Torah, since God is the source of all reality, So when he gave this halachic system, it is real, not because I could abstract it from the physical world. It's real because God gave it, and since God is the source of all reality, this makes this a reality. This makes halacha a reality, different than any other system of law. In other words, we hold that every human being starts from an incorrect view of life, from an emotional fantasy world of life. And then they have to move slowly in a slow process into the world of reality and to find God through reality. Now the question is that if you're looking at God simply as an authority, and the question is how to work your way out of it. The first step is to realistically know who God is, right? In other words, by who God is, I mean what you cannot know about God, that he's not physical at all, no relationship to the physical, things like that. And two, you must know how God relates to us. That's the reality, you see? Sometimes by studying the reality, it could take you away from the fantasy world to a certain extent. It's only after that you know reality that you can start seeing where your emotions are not in line with that reality. But first you have to know the reality to know what it's not in line with. It is then that you have to deal with the logic itself, and the reality itself does not help you get out of it, then you must deal with the emotion that is not letting you relate to reality correctly. I'd like to start with a verse in Mishlei. It's chapter 28, verse 24. Somebody says he steals, if somebody steals from his father and his mother, and he says, I have not sinned, he is a friend, a chaver is a friend, he's a friend to a man of destruction. Okay? All the commentaries say, some learn it metaphorically, the verse, but on the literal translation, all the commentaries say that he steals from his parents, but he rationalizes that he's going to get it anyway. You see? They all add that one point. He rationalizes that he's going to get it anyway, and why he is a friend is that because with that rationalization, that's a step towards stealing, and it's just that once you take that step, you just take step by step until you don't have to rationalize. Okay? What I'd like to bring up from this verse is mistakes that we make in logic in everyday life that's not noticeable. Like this one, you know, I'm going to inherit from my parents anyway, therefore I own it, you see, so I am not stealing. That therefore is a step that is irrational, you see. In other words, we always discuss it from the angles of the emotion, but there is also a mistake in logic too. Whenever you make an irrational move, there has to be a mistake in logic. And there's a very subtle mistake, and that is, like for instance in this case, the subtle mistake is that I'm going to inherit, therefore I own it. That therefore is a mistake. Okay? I'd like to give you another example. A person can't help compare himself to others. Let's say you're in a classroom or at work with others, and naturally you compare yourself. But if you fail, and you say, therefore, I'm weak, there's something wrong with me, or if I am better, if I do better than the person, therefore I am great, that therefore is incorrect. Why? Because there are many reasons why a person is successful or fails. If you're lazy, then even if you're doing better than others, there's some lazy people that they have very good heads, and they do better than others. That they can't take as a pat on the back, as a reward, you see. On the contrary, they should look at themselves as weak because they're not doing their potential. On the other hand, if a person is not doing as well, but he's doing his potential, he's doing everything he can, so then he can't condemn himself. So it is a natural thing to make comparisons, but however, the therefore, again, is an irrational step. And if you stop to think about it in that way, you'll see many times you put yourself down or build yourself up, not in the correct in an incorrect manner. All right. Let's say, for instance, a person is rational, and in logic he is really correct over another. You see, and therefore he suddenly feels that he is better than the other person. So again, that therefore is incorrect, because so you don't know the situation of the other person. I mean, if you look back, you know, how you became a thinker, what situation you were in, and the other person didn't have that situation. There's an interesting medrash. I don't remember. It was someplace in the Gemara. It says something like this. I don't remember the source, but it says something like this. There was a Tano on Amora that was giving a class, and he was talking about Ahav. Ahav was one of the worst kings in the history of Israel. He brought in foreign gods. He introduced foreign gods into Israel. And he married a foreign wife that was into idolatry. And so this Tana, when he was teaching about him, to make fun of him, he says, "My student Ahav." So the Gemara says that night he had a dream, and in the dream Ahav came to him. He says, "If you were in my generation," he says, "you would have grabbed onto my coattails and ran after the idolatry." You see? So the next day he came into class, he says, "My teacher, Ahav." Okay? What does it mean? It means you can't look down on other people. You just don't know why they are that way. You might have had a different situation than they, and they might have done much better in their situation than you would have done in their situation, or if they were in your situation, they might have done better than you. But you can't compare where I'm in one situation and they're in another situation. In reality, I'm doing better. Well, that's no compliment. I just happen to be in a better situation. Let's say, for instance, a person is lazy. Sometimes you could work it out rationally and get a person out of his laziness. Sometimes it's deep emotions and he needs help. You can't say, "Well, I'm lazy and I force myself, and he's lazy and he is not forcing himself." Maybe you have the ability to force yourself. Maybe you're lazy, but you also have an opposite motive that drives you to counteract the laziness, but they don't have that counteracting motive. I mean, there's so many factors in a personality, it's very hard to compare. You know what I mean? So you can make the comparison in the act. I mean, it's obvious. You see a difference. But to say, "Therefore I'm bad," or "Therefore I'm better," you can't do that. You don't know.
Rabbi?
In other words, in this particular case, people evaluate themselves in relationship to others. Therefore, people have bad self-images, or they have good self-images, or dependent on how successful or how much they fail in life. But that comparison is not real. That comparison is not a complete... all you could say is when somebody is not living the... Let's say, for instance, he doesn't accept the idea of God. Okay? So he will not have a place in the world to come. That's all I could say. It's a consequence. Somebody walks in front of a truck going 70 miles an hour, I say he will be hurt. But blame is a very hard thing to... I don't know how to place blame. It would be a hard thing. That's in the hands of God. I mean, when I was a kid, asbestos, there was nothing wrong with asbestos. So if somebody played with asbestos, he could have gotten sick. Today, it would be wrong. In those days, it wasn't. So, I mean, how can you blame a guy for playing with asbestos? I mean, they're different situations. And the situations are so detailed, and you don't know which factor is causing what, it's hard to condemn another person. But you can't say, all you can do objectively is show the consequences of certain lifestyles. That's all you could do. When people start out in life, they think free will, that they could do anything they want, become anything they want, total free will. Then when you start analyzing the personality and you see how much your personality has an effect on you, then your question is, well, then where is free will? You see? That is a abstract. That's a subject of study. I mean, it's not a simple thing, you see. But there, we hold that there is free will. We have that through prophecy, through the Torah. We have we accept the idea of free will. Now you have to work out where it lies. I'd like to show another type of irrationality in everyday life, and that's affirmative action. Affirmative action is that we were unjust to minorities. And so therefore what we said, if we to right this this injustice, so we went and says we will be unjust to the majority. In other words, like this. You want to get in a university, the way you get in a university is dependent on your scholastic skills. Not dependent on the color of your skin. So what happened is we first started with the color of our skin because that the whites could get into college and not the blacks because we were in the majority and we controlled it and we were bigoted. So we said the whites are better than the blacks. But then when we decided to be just, so we said no, now we'll give better chances to the blacks to get into college and not the whites, even though they're not deserving. When really, the way you should measure getting into college is based on your scholastics and not on the color at all. So they went from one injustice to another injustice. You see, that was a logical mistake. They couldn't think through. They skipped the step that let's evaluate what is the quality that is necessary to get into college or university, you see. They did not deal with the quality of getting, of what is necessary for success at a university. They just dealt both times with the color of the skin. In other words, you use one irrationality to overcome another irrationality. That was the logical mistake. The question is could God become physical? Like, or could God create a rock that he can't lift? Or could he create a jail that he can't get out of? Could he create somebody stronger than him? Okay? All these questions seem to imply that if you say that God can't do it, that God is weak. Okay? So therefore, we want the answer. When you say can't, that doesn't necessarily mean weak. If I say, if you play basketball, and I say you cannot make you cannot miss the shot, you can never miss a shot, that is not a weakness. Or if I say you can't get sick, that is not a weakness. That's a strength. So can't is not a weakness. It's putting a positive quality in a negative way. In other words, like I'll say you're always healthy, right? Or I say that you can never get sick. Let's say I put it in a positive. You always must be healthy. I mean, that's a good quality, you see. Now, students asked me a question, but Rabbi Moskowitz, when you say the word can't, isn't it a limit? If you say can't, I don't care what you're saying, the word can't means limit. And therefore, if you accept that, which I have to accept that can't is a limit, then he says that God is limited. So therefore, you're still caught in the question. But God is limited. The thing is that the term limit, see, when you say the word limit in everyday life, they take a step. You see, an automatic step, and say, therefore you are weak. That's implied in the term limit. You see? But the truth is that that's not true. You see, I'll show you what I mean. When our sages say that God is infinite, could you grasp the idea of an infinite being? No, I can't. When we study infinite, it's only the idea, but we can't grasp something that is an infinite being, you see? So the only way you could understand God is by putting it in the negative. What we mean that God is infinite, we mean that he is not weak. That is exactly what we mean, you see? The word limit means simply, doesn't mean weakness, you see? In everyday life, when you're limited, that shows weakness. Is God limited? Yes. Is God weak? No. It's two different things. We confuse the word limit by saying, including a therefore in the term limit in everyday life. You see? So when we say that, when you say the word can't about God, and you ask me, is God limited? I say, yes, God is limited. Is he weak? No. You see? But in everyday life, we use the term limited as a therefore you are weak. That point, that therefore, I disagree on. It's not the limit that I disagree, it's the therefore that I disagree. You see? And I say that when our sages are talking about that God is infinite, they're talking about that God is not weak. But can God create a rock that he can't lift? No, he cannot. Is that a limit? Logically, yes, it's a limit. But is it a weakness? No, it's not a weakness. That's how I want to... I just gave this again to show how we use terms in everyday life and we get confused with the terms and we include certain therefores or other types of logic that really does not work, and you miss the step, and we miss step and miss out on the true interpretation of the view, because in everyday life they're not precise and they can't make these distinctions, so they just have included many ideas in it, and that's the mistakes of that's a logical mistake that people make. Affirmative action was a different type of logical mistake. But there are different types of logical mistakes that seem to make sense, but only because we didn't really analyze every single step. We're going back to the verse in Mishlei that it says that it was a man. It doesn't say he's a man of destruction, but he's a friend of a man of destruction. The answer is because the first step that you take is a rationalization that you're really not evil yet. But evil has a way of once it becomes part of you that you could steal in this rational way, then you take another step where you steal in an irrational way. You see, you start becoming, you don't need a rationalization anymore. You don't need to rationalize. There's nothing wrong with stealing. You see, it's that, not that you are there yet, you're a friend of them, but you're not there yet when you make this rationalization. But this first rationalization, this first step that you take, that say that since I'm going to inherit, therefore it's mine, that step, if you take that therefore, then it will not be long before you will be actually a destructive person. But at that point, you're only a friend of a destructive person. The question is that if you're saying that an irrationalization is wrong, so then what's the difference if you have rationalization or you stop rationalizing and you just hold that it's okay? The answer is that as long as you have to rationalize, there is a conscience. Why are you rationalizing? Because you have a conscience, you feel guilty about doing it. So there is still hope there. I mean, if you don't catch it, then you will continue on, but at that point there's still hope because you still have a certain amount of conscience, you see, a certain amount of guilt, and that could make you think about it and make you a thinker and say, maybe I'm wrong. So there's still some hope. But once you don't have to rationalize, which means you hold it's correct, then it's practically impossible to get a person back. Once they hold there's nothing wrong with what they're doing, on the contrary, they'll show that it's 100% right. Everything they do is right, you know what I mean? Like, they don't need a rationalization. They don't feel guilty anymore, you see? But as long as you still feel guilty, so there's still a hope that maybe that guilt could stop you someplace, and maybe you'll have to repent, you'll have to do tshuva, and try and change your ways. That's a difficult thing. But once you took that step, but the fact is that you could catch yourself. And once you stop rationalizing, it means there's no conscience. Once there's no conscience, to make it back is a practical impossibility. All right. We're on in Bereishis Aleph. That's Genesis 1, verse 26. Okay? And it says, God said, let us make man in our image and our form. Okay? And, okay? So, the Sephorno wants to know, what does it mean, Bitzalmenu, in our image? And I'll read to you in English. He says, when it says in our likeness, the Sephorno says, indeed, that he be in a small way, he, man, will be in a small way like the heavenly host. Heavenly host is the angels, insofar as they function with knowledge and recognition and understanding. However, their actions, i.e. the angels, are performed without freedom of choice, and in this sense, man is not like them. Okay? In other words, he's saying that the angels work without choice. They must do that which is the correct thing. And the human being does have choice. Okay? That's what the Sephorno says. Difference between man and the angels. Okay? Now, the word angel in Hebrew is malach. Malach is a messenger of God. Okay? I'm only familiar with two messengers, so my deduction that will follow will be based on that piece of information. And that is, one of the messengers of God is the laws of nature. Through the laws of nature, God relates to us. And then where God relates to us in God's personal supervision, which is based on good and evil, so God relates to us based on good and evil. So we really live in two worlds that God relates to us through these two things. Okay? Now, the thing is that, from my understanding, these two things are not aware of themselves. They just operate. They're just logical ideas that the world functions through these ideas. But the human being is aware, has to be aware, to make a decision of the two parts. He has two parts and he has to make a decision between the two parts, so he has to be aware of himself. So I just want to say that malachim, or angels, or messengers of God, are not aware of what they're doing. It's just a rational thing. And a human being is. That's
That's all. I'm just taking that one step. I'm not sure how the laws of nature relate to the physical world. All I know, it is the cause of the physical world. How it directly relates, how it causes, I don't know. But however, it is the cause of the physical world. What we start from the physical, and we work back to the ideas of the physical world, and from the ideas we work back to God. God, on the other hand, started from within himself, started the laws of nature, and then from the laws of nature created the physical. So we're going in two different directions. I have a slight observation, and that is this. You notice that lashon hara, gossip, is always a judgment about another person. It's either how they dress, morals, ethics, justice, how they act, different things. It's always a judgment call. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, since it's not thought out, this judgment call is not thought out, so therefore, the question is, where does judgments come from in the human psyche? It comes from the conscience. Is that correct? Right? Now, if it comes from the conscience, then let's say, for instance, I'm down on myself. You say, like, I feel bad that I did something wrong, or I didn't do something good enough. Right? So it's the same conscience that judges others that judge me. In other words, the same way that I would judge others would be the same way that I would judge myself, since it's based on the same conscience. And therefore, getting rid of gossip would be also getting rid of, once you recognize that justice, getting rid of gossip would also get rid of your own condemnation of yourself, your bad, which causes bad moods and make you feel bad, or vice versa. If you get rid of that which you condemn yourself for, so then simultaneously you would get rid of all lashon hara. Either way, the conscience works like this. We have an animalistic part of us. That is all the base desires that you see in primitive tribes and people that let loose on all their emotions. These are the primitive emotions, right? The purpose of the conscience is to say no, okay? To say no to this part of you, and it uses the tools of shame, fear, and guilt. And it stops you from really being an animal. You understand? Okay? Now, as a result of the conscience stopping the animalistic part of us, so the question is, what type of enjoyment do I get? So I transfer that enjoyment of the animalistic part of me to a thing that needs control. In other words, competition. In other words, where I evaluate myself, you see? Where you understand, where I evaluate myself, like competition, you see? So the thing is there's a certain pleasure that's a result of the conscience. And this is the ego, all the ego pleasures are based on that. Okay? The Rambam says that that when it says that Adam ate from the tree of knowledge, so he got knowledge. So people think that that was a great thing, that he got knowledge. He says, but the catastrophe, they didn't realize the catastrophe of now having to undo when they got the conscience. You see, because it says that before they were nude and they didn't recognize that there was anything wrong with that. Then afterwards they felt the shame. So what is that thing, shame? Shame comes from the conscience. So when it came from the conscience, this is a class Rabbi Chait had on tape. He has on tape this whole class about Adam. But anyway, but the thing is also, Rabbi Chait mentioned that as a result, I think he quoted a medrash, as a result of that, you see, before we used to eat like animals, because we had no ego. We used to eat like animals, like from the tree, just like they did. But after the after we had the conscience, then we also got the ego, which was a result of the conscience. And therefore, we couldn't eat like other animals. And therefore, we had to produce our food so that we shouldn't feel like a nothing. Because if I just ate like the animals, I'd feel like a nothing. But here, I satisfy my ego. See, I accomplished something. I planted, and I sowed, and I made the bread, and I made this, and I made that. There's a certain ego feeling of satisfaction. So therefore, we couldn't live in the Garden of Eden anymore, is because we couldn't have everything handed to us because the ego would not be satisfied. You see? So we have to do it in such a way that we should be distinguished from the animals. That is where the ego comes in. In other words, before the sin, we lived just with the mind was able to deal with the animalistic part of us. The Yetzirah was able to deal with that. Just the mind. But after we sinned, the power of the emotions became so great that the mind alone would not be able to deal with it. So therefore, God instituted a new part of the human, namely the conscience. With the conscience came the ego. It was a natural result of the conscience. And so therefore, now, before we could reach back to pure pleasure and learning, and without the conscience and all the conflict that the conscience is involved in, and all the things that we have to do to satisfy the conscience, so we have a lot of work to undo. A lot of our conflicts is based on that. And so therefore, that was a terrible catastrophe. All this could be found in greater detail, more proofs from Rabbi Chait's tape on Adam HaRishon, on Adam. First man. He did not get, when he ate from the tree of knowledge, he did not get knowledge. You see, before he ate from the tree of knowledge, the only thing was true and false. He studied about the world of God, and the knowledge would tell him not to eat of the tree. That's all. He only had that command, right? But after that, the conscience causes you to get involved in the view of good and evil. And the first view of good and evil is based on the way you were raised. It's not based on reality. It's a false view of good and evil. Good and evil is not an exact science. You understand? It's not like true and false. And therefore, so first of all, you have an incorrect view of the good and evil when you start out, and you have a life of good and evil. And then you have to straighten that out and all the conflicts that come with it. Then you could, that's part of perfecting your soul. That is part of perfecting your soul, to straighten out all these conflicts so you could see clearly the ideas and reach God through the correct ideas, through the true, and really you relate to God between the true and the false. Science would see the true or false, or the Torah. But when it comes to morals and ethics, that is the good and the evil. So that's a very difficult thing to work with. The best, getting back to our original subject about the judgment that you make of others and of yourself, it's the same thing. So the best start, the best way to start is to simply look at people objectively and try to define what their emotions are. You see, and not to judge them, just to know. The best way, by not judgment, is just look at consequences of their actions. Just figure out the consequences of their actions. But emotions tend to look at things as good and evil. You say, this is a terrible thing. You know what I mean? Like, take smoking. Smoking has reached a level of evil in certain people's mind. It's really not evil. It's harmful. It's not evil. You see? But evil is where you punch somebody out. You see? The emotions put everything in terms of good and evil. You see? And it's very hard for the emotions to see another side because this is inbred in you. You have to train yourself. So therefore, there should be a training to be able to look at things objectively and just to define when a person does an act, not to condemn them, but just to analyze what could be the consequences of such an act. What would be wrong with such an act that would lead to consequences? The question is can you judge a person altogether? It's a very hard thing because if a person is raised a certain way, I mean, that already sets in motion a lot of factors about how they're going to operate in life. And if they come in contact with reality, how they're going to relate to that reality. And those people that come in contact with reality is they have a better chance of their situation is better than a person that didn't come into contact with reality at all. So it's very hard to judge a person. It's very hard to judge. You could only say the consequences. But the fact is, there is such a thing as free will. So in a free will judgment, I guess there you can condemn a person if you know that the person had a free will situation and made a free will decision, and therefore maybe you can condemn them. I don't know. But definitely, definitely, from looking, it's really very hard to condemn people. If you look at your own life, there's very little you could compliment yourself about. You could see or condemn yourself about because it's basically you look at life the way you were raised, and then certain situations which affected you. You see. So if you were raised in the house of a tzaddik, there's a better chance that you're going to be a tzaddik. If you were raised not in the house of a tzaddik, then it's a matter of chance who you meet, that somebody will open your mind to see certain ideas so that you could change your ways. So how much could you take credit for yourself? You know, it's very hard to take credit. They asked Einstein, could he take credit for his, you know, about his theories? He says, no, if I didn't have this guy that guided me to the mathematics and this guy that guided me to this book or that, he says, I would have never come to this conclusion. He says, you can't take total credit. He says, there are things that all along the way, I mean, there's something guiding you, personality, mental abilities, all these things. So it's very, when you think of all these factors, then it's very hard to take credit or condemn yourself. It's just a fact of life. The only thing is, you can protect yourself against consequences through the study of Torah. That's all the Torah says. To try to protect yourself according to the for the consequences. So therefore, you get rid of judgment altogether. The only time you could judge a person is if he's going to destroy you. So again, it's only because of, in other words, the Palestinians. I mean, did they have free will the way they were raised? I don't know. But should I destroy them? Yes, because I don't care what the cause is, but it's not right that they just destroy society and force everybody to be their slave. So I think that's unjust. But could I blame them? I don't know if I can blame them. I leave that to God. See what I mean?
Just like having
you see, in our society, a lot of people say about killers, well, they couldn't help it because they were raised a certain way. See, they're working on whether you could condemn them or not. Could you condemn them for having that lifestyle? No. I can't. I don't know what their life, you know, what all the causes in their life. But should I get rid of them? Yes, because I have to protect society. Like you gave an example that if there's a deadly spider in your house, you have to kill it. It's not that the spider is evil. The spider is only doing what spiders do. You see? But you would still destroy it to protect yourself. You see? Or you get rid of dirt to remove germs from the house. That's all. But could you condemn the germs for being germs? I don't think so. You know what I mean? So the thing is that there's two separate things that society can't make a distinction. Society works by the conscience, so they either call a person evil, and they hold this person is evil, and he's wrong, and he should change his ways, and he should know better, or they say, no, he can't help himself, and therefore you should let him free and do whatever he wants, because he can't help himself. Those are the two extremes, you see. Now, the thing is, psychologically, I say, yeah, but I agree with the people that hold that some people can't help themselves. They were raised a certain way, and they didn't have the situations that I did. On the contrary, maybe if they had my situations, they'd do better than me. You know what I mean? But, however, that doesn't take away the fact that I have to protect society and the consequences of that they bring about. So therefore, based on the consequences, should we kill them? Absolutely. You see? Whatever it takes. Whatever law, you know, assigns to different acts. So either it's death or whipping or punishment, whatever it is, whatever the society of Torah holds from a system of justice. But could I condemn them? No. In fact, there are people that can get the death penalty, according to halacha, and still have a portion in the world to come. Two separate things. You see? So, I mean, if a person accepts the 13 basic principles of faith, the 13 animamans, he has a conviction about it, but in a moment of rage, he killed somebody. He didn't really mean it. He couldn't help himself. That person has to get the death penalty. But however, he has a portion of the world to come. The problem with the conscience, it can't make distinctions. You see? Can't make distinctions. Everything is either evil or good. You see? It's very clear. Evil or good. You see? So, therefore, you need the mind to make distinctions based on justice and real true ideas, that you start making clear distinctions between the two, you see? In that way, you can move from the good and evil of the emotions to the good and evil of truth and the true ideas. Now, the question is, can you always judge by consequences? You can't judge by consequences, because the person smokes, he's gonna die, right? But that doesn't mean he's evil. He was harmful to himself. But if somebody blows up the Twin Towers and kills millions of innocent people, that's evil. The consequences are different. One is a consequence to yourself, and one is a consequence to society. You see? That's different. You have to know the difference. You can't put everything in the same category. A person that protects himself because of the consequences, that's a chacham. That's a wise person. A person that recognizes how he impersonally is affected by society. In other words, like when Enron cheated and they blew up the Twin Towers. All this affected the economy, and then it comes down to me personally, it affects me, so I see the consequences of justice. These two categories of a chacham and a tzaddik, the book of Mishlei deals with. There's a higher level where I don't care about myself, I just do it for the will of God. That's the book of Psalms that deal with that level of person. That's the level of development. You see? But the consequence level, the beginner's level, where you can't do it only because of God, but you do it because you see the consequences to yourself, the first step is you see wisdom, and you see how to protect yourself in particular situations. Then there's a further development where you see the society, and you see how it affects, how the society can affect your life, how they operate, affect your life. And therefore you try to be just because you see the consequences to yourself. And therefore you must try to help society benefit itself and to protect itself against these type of people because you see the harm. If you reach the higher level, that level of chassid, which the Psalms talk about, then you do the same thing, but you do it for the love of God. In other words, how you evaluate justice is or what is correct, or justice, is not based on the consequences. When I see the consequences of being unjust, that causes me to want to be just. What is justice? That's a study in and of itself. What is justice? That's Mishlei talks about when you study halacha, like for instance, especially when you study law, civil law, and how the courts were made. So then you get an idea of what the Torah holds from justice. You see? So that's a separate subject. What is justice? What causes you to want to be just is the consequences of a terrible society and how it affects you, and the effects of a good society and how it benefits you. So therefore you want to be just and try to relate to the society, benefit the society for that reason. Like I said, then there's a higher level of development through, by the way, this is a development through the mind. A lot of people keep halacha and they're very just because they obey God, but it's not a development of the soul. In other words, you can keep justice because God commanded, because you know God gave the Torah, and you obey God because he's God, so you follow the Torah, so you will be just that way. But a development of the soul is a development as the mind sees rationally why I should do these things. In other words, I'm obligated to obey God whatever he says. But then I also have the responsibility to understand what the benefit is to me. So the first step is I do all these things because God commanded me. Okay, but I don't see any benefit in it. You see? So there might not be a benefit. I just do it because of the world to come. God told me. Fear of punishment. You see? But then when I want to understand why God made these laws, so the only way I could understand it is the benefit to myself. So then as I study Mishlei, so then I want to keep it because the benefit to myself. Then when I study the Psalms, then I see the benefit. Then I am drawn to God through his wisdom. So when I'm drawn to God, then I want to do it because of God's will. That's a different type of person that's doing the law than the person that's doing it because God commanded me. It's a different the nature. In other words, both might do the same act. They both might keep halacha exactly the same. But the nature of the person is very different in the development. Now, just a review of the basic idea of what started this discussion. Okay? And that is that that a person has a conscience. It's a set thing. And that is the thing which you make judgment. You judge good and evil based on the conscience. Okay? Now, the way you judge others is the same way you judge yourself. You see? So therefore, if you want to know how you judge others, if you want to see how you judge yourself when you're depressed or when you feel bad, you're saying there's something wrong with me, you feel bad about yourself, then the good way is to look about how you judge others. And that can help, even though it's not clear, because when you're talking Lashon Hara, you might, let's say for instance you're talking about dress. So you might hold that if you don't know how to dress, that shows ignorance. That's the way you're raised. It shows that you show ignorance. Another person feels that if you don't know how to dress, you're not accepted in society. You understand?
another person, you don't know how to dress your lower type of person. I mean, everybody's conscience is different. But when you say the general Lashon Hara, everybody accepts it, you see, for their own view of the judgment. You see? They don't realize they really, it's very possible there's a group of people that's all agreeing about the same Lashon Hara, but they're very lonely people because they're not really talking to each other. They have different aspects of the story that they're attaching to. You see? So therefore, it's not always easy to know which aspect your unconscious, the part which you're not aware of, is attaching to. That's a little more difficult to figure out. But however, the fact is that somehow you are looking at. In other words, if there was an area that you had no judgment at all, you would not speak Lashon Hara in that area, and you would not enjoy. Lashon Hara in that area because it doesn't satisfy your conscience. And when you feel bad, it's the same conscience which is condemning you, and therefore it must be the same things when you condemn others, it must be the same thing. In other words, again, to change from the conscience, from condemning yourself for different things, you have to change in other words, you could change logically by first only looking at consequences and two, looking at the causes which brought you to wherever you are, whether for better or for worse, you see? In other words, did you do the best based on your mind and your personality and your situation to do you do the best that you can? You see?
And that you can't change anything.
And that you cannot change. That's a very good point. And you can't. And you might as well know that you can't change anything that did happen. So don't bother condemning yourself. Just bother straightening it out and dealing with it. That's all. It's absolutely true. That's the way to do it.